Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Because it's time. It's time for reparations.
LGBTIQ rights are black rights. We have always been here. Black queers, we will always be here.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me or sound like me.
I'm Gary Foley.
I'm Francesca Ramsey.
This is Amir Rahman.
And you're listening to The Race Card.
Welcome to The Race Card. I'm your host, Ahmed Yusuf, and joining me in studio today, we've got Amina Ziad.
Hey.
Before, we'll be doing an acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners of the land on which we meet, and we pay our respects to their elders both past and present. This land was never ceded, and the process of colonization, occupation, incarceration, and genocide that began over two centuries ago continue to this day. You're listening to our one-hour show where we talk politics, current affairs, and public culture with a little bit of a twist. Joining us in studio, as I said before, is Ruby Hamad, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But today we'll be looking at how the Solon Generation never ended with Indigenous ex-founder Luke L. Pearson, talking about Rebel Wilson's BAFTA speech, and that'll kind of make you gag. And our feature discussion is on white supremacy and decolonizing body and movement. I'd like to introduce you, Ruby. Ruby, you're a writer and columnist for The Daily Life. You're one of the prominent voices right now. You're blushing a bit, but like, it's true. You're one of the prominent voices right now when talking about race in Australia. I know you've spoken a bit, maybe more online, about kind of the troubles you've had finding a voice in a very kind of white media landscape, especially talking about race, which is usually a touchy subject, especially in Australia. So how difficult has it been breaking through?
Okay, yeah, it took me a while to, I guess, break in, and I feel like I'm still kind of breaking in. It's not, I don't feel, I guess, comfortable. I don't feel like I've made it or anything like that. I just keep doing what I'm doing. But I didn't start off writing about race. I'd started off writing more political and feminist issues, which, not to say that race isn't both of those things, it is. But I guess I didn't put an explicitly race sort of spin on it. But I did notice, you know, a few years ago, that there was a gap in our conversation about race. There's been some great writers working longer than I have, writing about issues, affecting people of color and, you know, Muslims in particular, because that's, you know, it's my background. I felt like there wasn't. I just felt like Australia was behind when it came to representation and to about the importance of pop culture and media and films, et cetera. And that there's kind of this sense of, you know, the reputable left-wing publications we had didn't really get into that stuff because it's kind of seen a bit frivolous. But from what I was reading in, you know, what was happening in the US and in Europe, pop culture is where we see ourselves reflected, and it drives our society and it reflects our society. And so if we could talk about, you know, whitewashing in films, which is a huge thing now, not so much, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, things like blackface and brownface, which is still going on no matter how many times we talk about it. It kind of gets to a point where you think they're just doing it on purpose now, because they can't not know the critiques that so many people of color have put about it. So I felt like there was definitely a gap, and I tried, you know, I remember 5 years ago, just trying to pitch things about blackface and about whitewashing and how important it was, and no one really wanted to know. And even though other publications were publishing me on other things, I felt like there was only a limit to how many Muslim voices they would give. And because I'm a bit of an unconventional Muslim voice, because I'm more secular and I don't approach it from a faith perspective as much, although I'll defend obviously the right of Muslims to practice their faith, I come from a more of a secular, or not even, but just a race issue, the way that race and faith intersects when it comes to Muslims. And so, you know, Daily Life was the first place where I really published an explicit article on whitewashing in Hollywood and what that says about our society. The backlash was enormous. Like, people didn't want to know. And I was quite surprised because I wrote something that I thought was pretty uncontroversial. It was about the film The Impossible, the tsunami, the Boxing Day tsunami, and set in Thailand, but of course it was centered around a white family, and everyone that was sort of affected by the tsunami in this film was all white. So obviously it was designed to sort of play into white emotions, but this was you know, the story of that happened in Asia, in Southeast Asia, and yet they were completely marginalized in this story, and people were talking about it in the New York Times and in the Guardian, and then I thought it was pretty uncontroversial. I'm like, well, we're not talking about it. We need to talk about it. But I just got this enormous backlash. People just did not want to hear that in Australia yet.
Why do you think that you weren't able to get published? Why do you think there was this propensity to not want to talk about race in the way you and the way Daily Life talk about race?
I just think that it's probably seen as frivolous and not important. I still get, you know, I see comments written about me on Twitter and whatever, oh, pop culture, who cares, you know, that sort of a thing. And, you know, it's not, I don't write it because I love these films. I don't write about whitewashing in the fashion industry because I'm a, you know, fashionista. I'm absolutely not. Like, the fashion industry, you know, I can, you know, not one of my favorite things, but it's important because it's part of our culture. You can't sort of deny it the way that it influences us and how, again, as I said, it reflects who we are. So when the fashion industry puts blackface in their magazines or doesn't use black models, even, you know, I remember once I wrote an article and I got really slammed on it by serious left writers on Twitter. I wrote an article about Fashion Week in Brazil and how they had like next to no models, but more than 50% of people in Brazil are black. How can a country where there's more than 50% black people not represented at all in one of their major cultural events, whether or not we think it's a cultural event that's important or frivolous, mm-hmm. or shallow? It's all those things, yes, but it's still a part of our society, and it's important. It needs to be talked about.
What's even funny is because this week a black Brazilian model, or I think black Miss Brazil, I think it was something to do with that, she had her title revoked from her.
There was what was the reasoning?
I didn't quite see the reasoning, but a lot of it pointed to race.
Well, there you go. I'll have to look that up.
I think what happened was she was actually pulled from her title because she was too black.
She was too dark.
And so they replaced her with someone who was lighter skin.
Have you noticed how people are either too black or not black enough? Like, we've had two comments, one by Bill Clinton and Meryl Streep talking about, well,
no,
we're all Africans. And white supremacy is a really funny thing.
I think that's important because we can't win in white supremacy.
No,
there's no winning.
It's stacked. Like, and that argument, sorry if I'm going off on a tangent, but this whole thing of, well, we're all black really, and that's what Bill Clinton said, we're all mixed race. And it's like, excuse me, you know, you're a Meryl Streep, Bill Clinton, you're Americans. 200 years ago, being mixed race is not going to stop a black person from being sold into slavery, and it would not have helped them during segregation either. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, the president, sold his own children that he had with a maid that he raped. So this idea, well, we're all mixed, no, that's something that white people use to their advantage when it suits them.
Definitely. Yeah. What I want to talk about now is you talked about Daily Life and how did that happen? Because now you're one of the columnists.
Yeah, I pitched an idea to them. I can't remember what it was. It may have been about the Sex and the City film, the second one, which was awful. You know, the one where they go off to Dubai.
India? Oh no, they went to Dubai.
Dubai or Abu Dhabi? It was one of the two, the Emirates. And it was awful. And she just, you know, the editor said, look, I this has just gotten so much press, we kind of want it to die. So we don't want this particular one, but we're very keen to have you write for us. So send me some more ideas. At that point, I'd been published in, you know, sometimes in the paper, in the Herald, in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age here in Melbourne. I'd also been published in The Drum, ABC, and Eureka Street, which is still one of my favourite places to write for, by the way. First place that ever published me, Eureka Street, which is a Melbourne publication published by the Jesuits. And so I've had some things out there, nothing regular. So obviously Daily Life, the editor, Sarah had been reading it and said, pitch some more ideas, and it started from there. So I started off just as a contributor, and then for the last year and a half now, I've been a weekly columnist, sometimes more than a week.
Because sometimes there are more racist things that happen in a week.
Yeah, I mean, I don't only write about race.
But that's what I want to talk to you about. Like, because oftentimes when people of colour start writing about race, whether it is a few articles here and there, they get pigeonholed into that. You only write about race issues. You don't write about politics. You don't write about elections or what have you. You just write about race.
You know what's funny? Like, whatever I write about, people that dislike it will tell me you only write about this. So, I mean, the other week I wrote about Israel. I wrote, it was about appropriation and just linking appropriation, cultural appropriation here in Australia via the, that meat and livestock ad for lamb. Just linking it to cultural appropriation in Israel, and someone wrote about it in some publication and said Ruby Hammett has returned to her favorite pastime of writing overwrought attacks on Israel. It's like, I think I've written about Israel maybe four or five times in the 6 or 7 years that I've been writing professionally. So this idea that it's, whenever they dislike what you do, they'll say you only do that. So I do write about race a lot more than I write about Israel. But they will say, well, that's all you care about is bringing down white people. When I write about feminism, same thing.
Just on that, so when people try to pigeonhole you and the kind of work that you do, the flip side is they don't actually want to have you on board because what they say is, what are you going to bring to the table? You know, what difference are you going to make? And what would you say to that?
I mean, I think it's a funny thing. Like, people will accuse me of being divisive. You know, this is an argument that people in privilege use all the time. No, you have to bring us together. What you're doing is separating us. What they're not taking into account is that we already feel separated. We feel marginalized. And we know that we're excluded. And so we're just bringing attention to it. We're not doing it to cause a deeper rift. We know there's a rift, and that unless we, and when I say we, I mean people of colour, unless we play along and accept this sort of inferior status that we have, then everything's okay and we're tolerated. But as soon as we identify this problem and say we want to fix it, then that becomes an issue. And so when you ask that, you mean when like sort of white people or the mainstream culture says this to me?
Both.
Yeah. I mean, I just say, look, we, the fact that they can't see that problem is their privilege. They know they can turn on the TV and they'll see themselves represented. We have the whitest television probably in the Western world. I've just come back from living in America for a year, and America is no paradise. Like, it's not the promised land, but you turn on the TV and they're in public access television, not just cable, but you turn on the television and people of all races are reflected. Well, I shouldn't say all, but there's a greater diversity, which we don't have here. Like, it's, I've written articles about it where I put pictures of, focusing on just morning television, comparing like TV, Australian TV shows to daytime television shows in the US, and the difference is stark.
We have this discussion almost all the time about like TV representation, and why do you think there's still a reluctance to have that?
It takes time. We feel like we've been having this conversation over and over, but in real terms, it's really only been the last few years that people of colour have said enough. Like, we want to be on television. I remember a few years ago where there was a couple of soap actors. One of them, I think, was on Home and Away, and Fares Durrani, is that his name? Denari or Durrani?
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And they pointed
he spoke about...
This was years ago, and they when they spoke out, they both, but it's particularly, and I can't remember his name, I apologize, I wasn't expecting to talk about this.
He was Elijah on Home and Away. Yes, I forget his real name.
Yeah, I apologize if you're listening. And he didn't get work after that. So he took such a big risk pointing out. And at that point, people weren't really talking about it. And now we are. But I guess it takes a long time because you have to think about why it's still happening. Who is in charge here? And the people that are still running the media and the television studios or whatever, they're white men. For the most part, maybe a couple of women, but they're white men. And so because, they can't really see the problem. They can't, or they say they can dismiss it because there's no personal experience for them.
Well, you've kind of seen the landscape, say, for example, because a lot of people, like growing up, like the younger generation, people, new writers emerging, are critical of Australia much more. A kind of like saying, why can't we be like the US or the UK? You've seen kind of the change, if you will, that's happened maybe the past 5 to 7 years. Are you seeing a change, or is it just more of the same?
I'm seeing like Australia is finally talking about it and identifying the problem. I mean, obviously there is a bit of a change. You know, you've got Walid Ali, who's now, on the project. So a few years ago, you wouldn't have seen, a brown face, much less a brown Muslim face, on such a mainstream show. And unfortunately, does tend to happen, and this is where I talk about the intersection of sexism and racism. When these opportunities do come up for people of colour, it's almost always a man. So women of colour are still kind of left lagging behind, unfortunately. But obviously there are some changes afoot, and I think we need more in the panel shows, the morning shows, the soaps, even though I don't watch them. It just needs to reflect who we really are, and young children of colour need to see themselves represented, because we might think that pop culture doesn't matter, but when you can't see yourself represented, it affects your self-esteem, and it affects your self-worth and your standing in society. You become invisible and you feel it.
Oh, I just want to add to that, that sounds like lazy indoctrination. It's like one of those things that can happen without much critique, and white supremacy can go on. And speaking of representation, I was doing some research yesterday, and Australia's population, like white population, makes up like 90%, probably more than 90%. I'm being a little bit vague here. I can't remember the exact.
Was it 90?
I think it's high. I think it's more like, but this is the thing, it's different. What kind of white are you talking about?
Well,
that's the thing, isn't it?
Are Greek people white? Are Italians white?
Well, they are.
Well, they came in under white Australia policy, right? They were allowed in.
So they are white.
They are white.
But they also
suffered from racism and exclusion. Yeah. So it's.
But do they still, like, the question is, like, I guess the idea is race is always, and this, it's because it's a social structure.
It's fluid.
Yeah, it's fluid, and it keeps on changing.
The parameters change.
Yeah. So now,
absolutely,
Are they more or less white?
Yeah,
I would argue yes, but I'm sure there are some that would probably.
Yep. Just to continue that point.
Yeah. Sorry.
So with the representation of people of color on television, a lot of people tend to say things like, "Oh, well, that's because there's just not much people of color." But when you look at it proportionally in terms of its ratio, representation of people of color in the media, or particularly in TV, is 0.08%. That's not even vaguely close.
So it doesn't even add up statistically. There you go.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a very particular, process going on.
That's a good one. I didn't thought of that. That's a very good statistic.
You might steal
it
for an article.
I will use that in the future.
Because we kind of briefly talked about the pigeonholing kind of thing. Is that something that scares you? Because sometimes you don't always want to write about race.
I don't always. I mean, I've written quite a few this year already. But for a while, there was a long stretch last year where I didn't write anything. I'll only write it if I feel like it needs to be said, I think. And that goes for anything. And, you know, for a while I was worried that I'd be pigeonholed as a Muslim writer. So I for a long time, didn't write anything about that again, partly because I didn't feel like there was something that I could say. Again, I don't write from the perspective of someone who's practicing, you know, the religion daily. And because I don't, you know, I'm not visibly Muslim. So my experience as a Muslim woman is a lot different to some others. So there are some issues that I would leave to the more sort of, I guess, visible Muslims who suffer a different kind of racism because they present as Muslim immediately. So that was a fear. But, you know, I feel like I'm starting to escape that fear a little bit. I'm being asked to do things that are not necessarily just about race or just about, you know, I mean, I'll be at the All About Women Festival next month at the Opera House in Sydney, and I'll be chairing a couple of panel discussions, neither of which are about race. So as much as I love talking about race, and I mean, you know, I've got something else coming up about race as well, I like to, you know, talk about.
Because you're because you have a fluid identity. Obviously, race plays a huge part
of that. Of course it does.
Like, for example, you don't have, like, white writers can usually write about anything and it doesn't matter. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to add to the previous point. One of the really good quotes that have been told to me, and I can't remember who it is, so unfortunately I cannot credit it, but someone once said, to write before you're written about. And I think that's very apt. And so when we say things like, I don't want to talk about it because it's, you know, not my experience. And yeah, rightfully so. How do you feel about, for example, white writers who can write about anything and write anything authoritatively as if they do have, you know, the capacity to do that?
I think the way they write is important. I'm not, like, there are certain times when an issue comes up that I feel that only someone from that community can write about it. Especially, you know, if they're writing about it in a personal way. So, I'm struggling to think of an example.
Well, like, especially if it's like an opinion piece. Like, if someone's gone out and done some interviews and writing like a feature piece, I can kind of like that's okay.
Yeah.
But like, if you're writing an opinion piece in an authoritative tone, saying like, this is this and this is that.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, white people are allowed to have an opinion on race. So if a white person writes about, say, what's jumping out at me, the Adam Goode saga, they can write it in a certain way. You know, they can't write about the importance that his, you know, Adam Goode's actions on the field and off the field had to the Indigenous community because they cannot possibly have the right experience.
Know.
They can't know.
Do you think it was hard, I guess, at those initial stages because there weren't that many people out there who were talking about race or were any kind of like misrepresentation in the media was very, very small.
Yeah.
Was it hard, like, continuing on even after those rejections?
It was hard. But look, in those days, I wasn't as aware of racism as I am now. I just wasn't. I also wasn't aware of sexism as much. I kind of bought into this whole thing that the West kind of had these issues figured out. I didn't really think about it at that, you know, when I first started writing. When even a person of color cannot realize the extent of how racist our society is until we start delving deeper and reading it, and then we start to piece together our experiences, and you're like, okay, so why did I get rejected with all those CVs that I sent out, which were pretty good, and I've got the skills and I've got the experience? And then, you know, you read about a study that says if you have an Arab-sounding surname, you have to submit, you know, what is it, like 68% more resumes, like almost twice as many just to get.
So, because today actually I was listening to an interview from this British Asian writer talking about racism in sport, and they were talking about the Rooney Rule. Rooney Rule, I'm not sure if you heard of it. In the NFL, they have this rule where every single NFL club, when they're trying to hire a new coach, they must interview one black coach, and that's a blanket rule they put in, I think, a few years ago, I think 12 years ago, and then it's changed, and now you see more black coaches in the NFL. Do you think something like that, in a more kind of sense of creating a media diversity, needs to come into Australia?
Yeah, look, I'm all for affirmative action. This whole idea that it unfairly advantages certain people. No, it's a measure against, you know, white privilege. We just, the job always goes, nearly always goes to a white person by default, or usually a white male by default. And affirmative action and these sorts of quotas are meant to at least get people from marginalized groups a look in, an opportunity.
Because, like, especially, like, so if we're talking about, say, public broadcasting specifically, we're talking about ABC, 8% of ABC's content makers are... 8% of ABC's content makers come from a non-English speaking background. 8%. That is 8% of. So this is the government. This is the a public broadcaster's public broadcaster who's you'd think would be looking to match mainstream Australia.
You know, you say this rule, this Rooney Rule, has resulted in more black coaches. It just shows that. Because the rule was they have to interview,
just
right?
Interview, just interview. Yeah. No
hiring.
So the
fact is they interviewed them and discovered, hey, these people have the skills and they've got the talent. So it's just they were overlooked before on account of their race. The fact that there was a quota or whatever for interview just shows that this person was then seen when they would not have been seen. They would have previously been invisible. The exact same person with the exact skills to bring to the table.
I would exactly. I just want to make this clear. Every single person that was interviewed would have to have the requisite skills and CV.
That is the biggest fallacy or myth that I think goes around about programs like that or affirmative action, the idea that you can just pluck anyone who's, you know, black or Arab or a woman off the street and they're just going to beat all the white people that have the talent and the actual knowledge or whatever. It's not the case. You still have to be good at what you do.
Oh, definitely. But yeah, also I feel like often you see people of colour not wanting to actually enter these roles because they don't see themselves reflected. Onus is on companies to actually invest in diversity. Because I think I was reading another article from Media Diversified about, like, white writing rooms and all this kind of jazz. It's like, more often than not, you're going to have something racist come up, something sexist come up, something homophobic come up, something transphobic, something deeply offensive if you do not... actually invest in diversity. What is worse, paying that lawsuit or actually trying to see a more diverse...
What's going on, people? This is Akala, and right now you're listening to The Race Card. Big up.
Now we're going to our segment, The Week That Was, where we highlight the most notable and infamous stories from the past week. First up this week, we're going to be talking about the winner of the most racist comment of the week award, and it goes to Alan Jones, Mr. Alan Jones, I should say, about his comments about... the stolen generation.
My open line number, Dell, hello.
Once again, I agree with you when you said, what was all that that went on before that match on
What
Saturday
was it?
Night? I mean, what a load of twaddle, and they even had to end with a minute's silence for the stolen generation. When are they going to believe that half the stolen generation were taken for their own protection?
Correct.
And I get
to look after them. And we need stolen generations. There are a whole heap of kids going before the courts now, or their families, mums going before the courts and dads, who are on top of the world with drugs or alcohol, and suddenly they go back into an environment where children are brought up in those circumstances. Those children, for their own benefit, should be taken away.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Del, we've gone mad, haven't we?
We have gone mad.
I just thought it was unbelievable.
Yeah, and, well... that was clearly rubbish and ahistorical about the history of the stolen generation. In the same week, Indigenous X founder Luke L. Pearson wrote an article about the stolen generation, how it never really ended. We're going to get Luke hopefully on the line right now. Hi, Luke. Thanks for coming on the show. In your article, you reference a few statistics that tend to go unmentioned, and I'll just read a few off. In June 2007, 9,070 Indigenous children were in and out of home care. In June 2015, that number has risen to 15,455. And in 2007, 45.3% of Indigenous children in out-of-home care were placed with their own Indigenous families. Today, that number has reduced to 35.9%. More Indigenous children are being removed today than at any other time in Australian history. They're 10 times more likely to be in in care than in their own than non-Indigenous peers. They represent only 5.5% of their age population, and they make up 35% of the children out of home care. So why aren't we talking more about these statistics, Luke?
But yeah, I should mention that that bit that you just referenced from my article, I actually quoted from Larissa Berendt in her article in The Guardian. So I borrowed those stats from that article. But a big part of the problem for me when the media usually looks about it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Larissa's was a shining example of what we should actually be talking about in the media. The story usually is just, are we at risk of a new stolen generation? A new report says we're at risk, or someone's quoted as saying we're at risk of a new stolen generation. And that story comes out every 3 or 4 months and has done for about the last 12, 13 years. I had a quick look when I was writing my article, and the oldest news story I could find saying it goes back to 2004. And so every few months they do the same story again, mentioning that it's there, and then it moves on. There's no real critical examination of what's actually happening, what's happening with the numbers, and what's happening with the government response to it. And so a big part of the problem is that the media just doesn't seem to have any real interest in actually being a part of the conversation at a deeper level. They just put it on the radar and then move on again very quickly. But when we actually look at government responses, when we look at what can we actually do to reduce these numbers, now, you know, no one's arguing, oh, well, God, unfortunately, there are people who are arguing that the numbers should be higher, which is just mind-boggling on so many levels that anyone would argue that the best place for a child is not with the family. But we need to be looking at what can we be doing as a nation to ensure that more kids are able to stay at home. And most of what happens in child removal is a response to poverty, is a response to intergenerational trauma. And there are things that can be put in place to help support these families so that this doesn't have to happen. And that's not happening across the board and hasn't been happening for a long time. A lot of money is pulled out of family support services. And these are the conversations we need to be talking about and need to be looking at very in depth and actually putting some pressure back onto government to say, what can we do to improve the stats? Yet, like I said, the same story for over 12 years. And within that period, the numbers have been skyrocketing.
Because on the face of it, it just looks like the government has repackaged the stolen generation policy into more palatable for like their own moral conscience.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, in so many issues, what we talk about was that, you know, in my father's generation, the racism was overt. In my generation, it's covert. But it's still largely the same things that are happening or drastically increase. And when we're talking about incarceration, you know, juvenile justice detention and out of home care, those numbers have absolutely gone through the roof since the time when we acknowledge it as a part of an overt racist approach. Nothing's happened to actually reduce it, and none of the racism has actually stopped. We just don't name it in the way that we used to. That's the only thing that's changed.
Because, like, a lot of times, this, I think you published your story on the either the eve on the day of the sorry apology from Kevin Rudd. Do you think that was, because I'm pretty sure on during that time or a few weeks or a few days, the Northern Territory intervention happened. Do you think that people like that story of oh, we're better now, racism is over, opposed to really looking at the hard statistics that we just said?
I think people love that story because it's so much better than the story that we're actually more racist now than a period where we recognise Australia was one of the most racist countries on earth. And so it's much easier to, you know, point to these symbolic gestures and say, oh, no, we're much better. You know, we're moving forward. And, yeah, we can point to some areas where there is phenomenal improvements. I mean, a lot of the services that exist now, you know, didn't exist a generation ago, but those services are currently under threat and facing, you know, massive staff cuts, defunding, and have always been grossly under-resourced and had to work within government systems that you know, do not empower them to work the way they need to work. So even though, you know, Aboriginal people have fought for these things to be in place, the government has consistently wound them down or undermined them since day one, and so much so that now they're actually unpacking them altogether.
Hi, Luke. Amina here. And so we're basically told that family is a basic unit of society. And so what these policies are doing is basically fracturing communities, or Indigenous communities particularly. And if we imagine the state as the head of, you know, head of the family or the patriarch, we can observe that this is actually genocidal practice. And that's not used. We've been talking about it for so long. But what is it about this insidious practice of fracturing families? Why is this particularly insidious?
Oh, it's hard to know how much of government bureaucracy and incompetence is, you know, overtly orchestrated to be that way, and how much is just the incompetence of bureaucracy. But, you know, much of what happened under the Stolen Generations through the Bringing Them Home report, you know, 20 odd years ago, was openly acknowledged as genocide by the UN Convention of Genocide. One of those definitions is removing the children from that core group. And so, yeah, any chance we're talking about of Indigenous empowerment, revitalising languages, culture, keeping communities safe, and, you know, the government, their three-pronged slogan of kids have to go to school, parents have to go to work, community should be safe, there's nothing that's actually happening on the ground to actually make that happen. And so, you know, there's a lot of conflicting theories varying from, you know, government understand exactly what they're doing and that the end purpose is what the purpose has always been for Aboriginal people, genocide, quite directly. And the other is that, you know, the government is just unwilling to recognise their own role in it. They're unwilling to acknowledge their own failures. And so they double down. You know, we know full well that punitive responses are not the best measure, that removing kids, that locking people up are not the best measures. Yet to actually seriously change that around, there's going to need to be a conversation that says, we acknowledge we've been doing the wrong thing. You know, within this modern generation that considers itself so progressive, but really as a continuation of colonial expansion since day one. And I don't know. And I think it does vary. I think there are some people within government who'd be very happy to see there not be any more Aboriginal people. I think there are some people who think this is the only thing that they can do and just, you know, are for some reason blind to the realities of what it obviously leads to, both. Yeah, you know, the numbers are there. They're unquestionable that the government responses for what they claim to be their desired outcomes are not working, and in fact moving the complete opposite direction.
Put more beautiful people of colour on TV and connect viewers in ways which transcend race and unite us. That's the real Team Australia.
You know, you look at the American TV, British TV, it, you know, has, you know, it's got shows with different nationalities. And not just putting nationalities just for the point of difference, but creating work that caters for actors of different backgrounds.
In my mind, I see a line. And over that line, I see green fields and lovely flowers and beautiful white women with their arms stretched out to me over that line. But I can't seem to get there no how. I can't seem to get over that line. That was Harriet Tubman in the 1800s. And let me tell you something. The only thing that separates women of color from anyone else is opportunity. You cannot win an Emmy for roles that are simply not there.
And also this week, unfortunately, some horrible Islamophobic things have happened. Something very sad, like particularly for me, because I live so close to Preston. Preston Mosque was vandalized, and Qurans were thrown to the ground, ripped apart, windows were broken, spray paint was sprayed all around the masjid, and basically something, a place where people go to Ongare for community and worship and spirituality, was turned into basically rubbish bin. And I guess, like, always we usually think of things like this to, we go, oh, it happens like in regional, you know, like regional Victoria or regional Australia. Oh, we don't need to worry about it. We're living in metropolitan Melbourne and where the progressive people live and all that kind of thing. And you just think about it, Preston isn't too far away from the city.
I was going to say, Preston is very multicultural as well. So it's happened in a diverse part of Melbourne, which is pretty frightening.
Yeah, where a lot of Muslims live.
Yes.
And like what kind of scared me, because I know there was some people from the Somali community fundraising for a new mosque, like a new center where Somalis can I don't know, congregate in terms of community and all that kind of stuff. And now, like, how are you going to feel making a new center in Preston when they just
the existing one?
And like, this is like not $100, $200 kind of like repairs. This is going to cost thousands upon thousands.
Tens of thousands. 200,000. Yeah. Wow.
How are they gonna, like, this is just,
well, I hope someone sets up a fundraiser for them, because they deserve it. I guess it's a good chance to show some community. I guess this is the environment we live in, though. Like, we have political leaders that think it's okay to bomb and invade Muslim countries at the drop of a hat, and they do so under the pretext that Muslim culture is intrinsically inferior. So why are we surprised when that manifests in violence against Muslims?
Exactly. And I think that's the thing that people need to understand, is that there is a correlation between foreign policy and domestic policy. So when you're fear-mongering in order to harness support for foreign invasions overseas, you're also allowing and brewing hatred domestically, and this is a direct consequence of that.
And I just thought I'd mention that, and we'll move on to some more racism. Really,
there's still enough. There's always too much. How do you want to look at it?
you thought things couldn't get stranger, but well, clearly you haven't heard Rebel Wilson's BAFTA speech seemed.
Are you going to play it now?
Oh, yeah,
excellent.
Yes.
Because I haven't heard it yet.
Oh, she seemed to take an affront to the suggestion of diversity in film and making a sly joke about the Oscars So White campaign.
I have never been invited to the Oscars because, as you know, they are racist. The BAFTAs have diverse members. And that's what we all want to see in life, isn't it? Diverse members.
Yeah. Well,
I don't even know what does that mean? What is she talking about?
The thing, like, at least that clip, just like, I don't know what she was trying to make of it. Just like, they're so, diversity is bad. It's just, and it didn't get better. It got worse. She kind of talked about, I can't even, I'll just play the clip.
One day, I hope to return here to win a BAFTA myself. I have already been practicing my transgendered face. And now, segue to the award of Best Supporting Actor. Sorry, Idris Elba, you're making me a bit nervous. But I'm just sociologically programmed to want chocolate on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I'm just socially, programmed to want chocolate on Valentine's Day. And you know, the thing is, like, beyond, like, because of all that, like, just recently, Idris Elba was actually talking about diversity in film. And seeing him, like, and the thing is, like, I'm not talking about kind of, like, I don't care that she made a racist joke. I'm more worried that a group of white actors were just laughing at everything and ate everything she set up, and then just imagine being Idris Elba in that situation, who was just talking about diversity on TV screens when he spoke to a group of MPs just over a month ago, and here's what he said to the MPs about the need for diversity.
In fact, Ford Dagenham had more opportunity and diversity than the TV industry I was trying to break into. In a funny way, broadcasting needs a Magna Carta. We need to start doing things more fairly. It's not so much as a peace treaty, but an opportunity treaty. We need to count up what everybody has, see the lay of the land, and see who has which careers in TV. Who makes TV, who's allowed on TV. And when they get the opportunity, which roles do they play off and on screen? You have to ask the question, are black people normally playing petty criminals? Are women always the love interest or talking about men? Are gay people always stereotyped? Are disabled people ever seen at all? Do some people have their careers taken away on a whim? Is their talent unfairly ignored?
And like I think that discussion needs to be had, and just imagine sitting in a room where you had this serious discussion, meeting with political people like politicians and what have you, and a few weeks later you go into the BAFTAs to hopefully maybe win an award, to be acknowledged by your colleagues, and a group of them are laughing about the idea of diversity.
Yeah, and your identity becomes a punchline.
Yeah, basically, like, then, literally, like, that's it. Right. I'm socially programmed to, like, what was it, chocolate on Valentine's Day.
This is like that, what was that joke that DJ put on, Australian DJ put on his Twitter
the Oreos,
or Instagram, and I'm the creamy filling between two chocolate biscuits. Like,
it's just... Yeah. Like the thing is just basically making a punchline, as you said, of this person, of Idris Elba's identity, making a punchline of Ice Cube and Kevin Hart, and it was just like these things. Like you'd think that you just really just stop for a moment and think about why are you doing this?
Yeah, because it's white supremacy in action. White supremacy and privilege breeds itself unthinkingly. It's one, you know, they're not making this joke in a vacuum. They're not making it in a world or a society where we're all treated equally and we have equal opportunity. They're doing it Rebel Wilson made that joke in an environment where 20 actors in every category, 20 out of 20 are white. And These are meant to celebrate all films across the spectrum. So when people of color can be excluded to that extent, and then you're making a joke of it, and that's why it doesn't work the other way. You know, making a joke about a white person is not the same thing, because my joke is not going to affect your privilege.
Well, basically the thing about like system, like talking about, so making a joke about black people being criminals. And comparing it to saying, oh, white people can't dance. It's
exactly.
Like one thing is like
you're not going to go to dance jail.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
You're not going to
be
thrown in jail for 30 years.
Exactly.
I'm banning all rap this year at the awards. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I love hip hop. Obviously. But tonight, it's all about soul. Yeah, but... Okay, hold on a second. I got another call. Wait a minute. Oh, Thugger! What's up, young Thug? No, honestly, man, you are my favorite artist out right now. But I ain't letting anybody in with no littles and youngs and their name. Yeah. Hang on one second. I'm sorry, y'all. Yes. Who is this? Iggy Azalea. Yeah, hey. Oh, no. You can come, because what you're doing is definitely not rap. Yeah. My overalls. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to send an Uber for you right now. Yeah. Come on, be outside.
So moving on to the feature, there's no question of the profitability of the fitness industry. What seems relatively positive and marketed as necessary for overall wellness, however, is hardly viewed critically across the board. Given the system our world largely operates by, fitness is not simply a lifestyle. It's reflective of an overarching ideology that has built an industry in its surrounds to commodify this. And by conflating bodies to social meetings and centralizing and marketing what fit, active, non-moving, and ordinary bodies should look like, we witness a propaganda of body idealism, which includes racialized expectations, as well as proliferating harmful, even appropriative associations. So through capitalistic endeavors, furthered by white supremacy and class, we are fed to believe that the ideal body on average is lean, which connotes health and wellness. And to be larger than lean is to be unhealthy, lazy, and all other social meanings imbued to it. And such meanings are then used to justify fat shaming, for instance. However, for the sake of constraining the breadth of this area, we'll be focusing on the appropriation and commercialization of yoga to demonstrate and further explore this. It is also by no means the only practice of meditation and movement to be quantified and orientalized by the white gaze, but it's just for the sake of reducing the breadth. So yoga, for listeners who are unaware, it originates from South Asia, and from a religious speaking sort of perspective, it originates from Hindu practice dating thousands of years. Along with the Kama Sutra, it was banned by British colonizers for being deviant and devilish and for being uncivilized. And by fracturing and diminishing the practice for several hundred years, the struggle to keep these cultural practices has since continued. Fast forward to the present day, where the practice of yoga is now associated with white skinny women who just want to be well. Take note, this critique isn't a personal one. It is a systemic critique of a historical and ongoing legacy. As one can be expected with the imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy, yoga is heavily commodified and divorced from South Asian Hindu authorship. And so now we see things like, you know, yoga mats, yoga pants, none of which makes sense. One of the things that is most insidious to me is the idea of the yoga body, because it proliferates white supremacy's idea of the ideal body. So even though, for example, there is way to be subversive in practicing yoga as a South Asian Hindu person, you can have these classes and you can still be in some kind of authorship. You can still, you know, market your products and still be in some kind of authorship. The idea of proliferating this body idealism is particularly, can only be applied to white supremacy. There's no way you can take that back. That's a very harmful thing that keeps getting
but,
like,
but also, like, aired around. If I talk to anyone, if I go onto the street and ask them, what do you think and what do you see when I say yoga? They will think blonde, white woman. That's right. The immediate image. Like, even me, like, right now, like, I get that image in my head. And it's just, like, because in everything, in popular culture, from every single thing, yoga is seen as this trendy, cool, hippie kind of thing. You can,
and wealthy, too.
Yeah, wealthy. And it becomes classless in that sense. And the people who actually originate from where yoga begun, unable to take these yoga classes, and also maybe they didn't even want to take these yoga classes to begin with anyway.
Right. And also, when you talk about, you know, those classes are very expensive and they're going to the pockets of, like, white people who can't pronounce or even do things right. So, for example, one of my friends, I think she went to a yoga class headed by this white woman, and she played the Quran as some kind of, like, relaxation mantra music or something. And
do you know what they do? Like, I feel like I can imagine a yoga session. So a yoga session for me is, so white woman with dreadlocks, obviously she needs her dreadlocks, playing, like, maybe even playing the Quran, or some sort of obscure Arabic sounding song, and then she's just, you know, just saying, does everyone remember that yoga ad where this person was selling kind of, like, I think it was, I can't remember the product, the yogurt product, but he was saying and having some yogurt.
Oh yeah, I do remember that.
And I can imagine her doing the exact same thing, but just minus the yogurt.
Yeah. I mean, some of them, their heart is in the right place, and I confess, I've been doing yoga since 2001, and I have a teacher certification as well. I don't teach, but I've done the training, some of it. It's a hard thing for me when it comes to yoga and the appropriation and colonization of it. Well, A, I'm not Indian, so I can't speak any sort of authority. But I do know from what I've read into it that, you know, yogis in India, the idea was to spread it as far and wide as possible because they felt that all of humankind needs it. But of course, that's true, but it needs it in a certain way. Like, it's become, and I see this, and just even in the last few years, has become a bigger and bigger problem. It has become
almost completely divorced from its spiritual, and I don't necessarily mean only religious, so you have to be Hindu, but this spiritual, this idea of reconnecting humans to each other and to the planet around them, because that's what a lot of yoga is about. You know, you have these poses that are named after animals and trees, and the whole idea is to remember that we're not actually completely separate beings, that our destinies are, and fate, you know, and our lives are interconnected, and we can hurt each other and hurt ourselves by hurting others, which is a great message. And that's sort of the spirituality of a lot of it. But it has become about the physical, because that's, and the ego, which is the Western way, the world, and we're taught to be competitive. So everyone wants to do the poses, and everyone wants to, you know, be the best handstand and this, and it's become more and more. As it goes along, and I know there's a new studio opening up in Sydney, and they're advertising. I saw the advertisement on Facebook, and it said tone, tighten, enlighten. And I'm like, well, no, if you're enlightened, you wouldn't care about the toning and the tightening. Like, it's not, it doesn't work that way. Like,
I think it was done in chronological order. Is that you have to tone, tighten, and then you can get enlightened?
Yeah. But you know, the thing is, when you do, and this is something that I'm really upset about with a lot of the yoga schools out there, they'll admit, oh, look, you know, it's not about getting the great body and being great, attractive and beautiful, and it's about becoming a better person. It's like, well, then why do you always have women in, you know, very attractive blonde women, white women, doing yoga in a bikini at the beach? That's the image you're projecting. And, you know, the yoga journals are all, magazines are guilty of that as well. You can't sort of say one thing and then do the other. If you're saying that yoga is for everybody, then it has to be for everybody. You can't make it aspirational, because then you're going to get those people that fit that bill, that can, you know, pump money into it. And that's the other thing. Yoga's way too expensive, mostly. It doesn't need to be that expensive, but, you know, at the very least, they should, like, give you the mats and towels for free and not have to hire them. But sorry, I'm going off on
But even, like, fine. What you're saying, right, it's this image that they present, and you have this idea that you can't do yoga because you're not as thin as a stick or whatever. And I remember seeing this video of this black woman who is bigger than the idea of the yoga master person, whatever, but she can do yoga like,
I think I've seen the one you mean.
And you know what I mean?
She can do poses I can't do.
Like, so it's not really about necessarily body. It's more about just, like, you know, your own body's flexibility, and you're able to.
Exactly.
And mastering yoga as it goes.
Exactly. And I think this idea that's also insidious, is in order to be fit, or what we imagine as fit, is a particular body. You know, like, I have friends who are lean and they can't touch their toes, you know what I mean? Yeah. Something like that. They can't run, you know, a mile or something like that. Whereas I know someone who's bigger who can, and they can do it faster. And we have to, like, decolonize the way we imagine our bodies and the way we move. And I think that's one way to kind of, like, subvert that idea.
Definitely. And I think we're almost about done here. Thanks.
Didn't get to talk about Beyonce's video.
Oh, well, like... well, we can do that.
I'll just throw it in. You guys do it next week.
We can do it next week. Yeah, we can do it.
Oh, and SNL's... hilarious. And,
oh, that was just amazing. Oh. I just loved... Do you know the video of... So the woman next to... this white woman was freaking out because, oh, my God, Beyonce's black. And then the other woman's right there and says... and then just freaking out.
Yeah. I just love when they're like, maybe this isn't for us. And then she's like, but usually everything is. It's like, I loved it. They really captured. So that's a good way that white people can talk about race. Like, you know, they're lampooning themselves. They're not pretending to know what that video means for black people, because it's up to black people to talk about that. But they can lampoon themselves and say, well, this is why that's we're all perfect. Freaking out, because we're so used to everything being about us. So that's a great way just to go back that how white people can talk to
And just on the whole Beyonce thing, I think Colette, you know, the jewelry store, I think they released, like, a poster or something that they're going to have a collection inspired by Beyonce's formation look, and it's just like, that's really not for you. It's
that's
not
appropriation.
For me either. That's not for us.
Well, yeah. What is Colette?
Colette is like a jewelry store. It's started by, you know, a white woman and her daughter in Northern Sydney.
Oh, I wish it was like a makeup store, because I would have just said that they probably wouldn't have Beyonce's shade. Yeah. But like, it wasn't. Yeah.
And the thing
work.
Is, like, on the poster itself, it wasn't even like a black woman. It was a white woman. Doing like the Beyonce's poses, and it was like, this has completely missed the point.
We're living in Australia.
They just have to keep recentering themselves. Yeah. It's just it's impossible for them not to. It's in their DNA totally. Now.
That's true. Well, okay. Thank you for coming on the show again, Ruby. It's been a pleasure.
It was my pleasure. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
It's all right.
And everyone, if you're a first time listener or just managed to find the podcast, you can find us on iTunes by searching in Racecard. You can find us on Acast searching in Racecard as well. You can find us on Twitter at The Racecard. You can find us on facebook.com/racecardshow. And also you can find us on our new and shiny website, racecardpodcast.com, where you can find all the information about the show. And yeah, so thank you for listening, and this is me saying goodbye.
Thank you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bye. Thank you.